Welcome to the Mike and Doug Show. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Doug.
Wow. Today we're going to talk about something a little bit out of the normal. We've talked about it before, but it's really an exciting topic. The Spear of Antioch, or the Spear of Destiny, the Spear of Maurice, it's called, it has many names. And we're going to talk about the history of that and the way that that plays into, believe it or not, the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and the whole desire of hegemonists, people who want to control the world, to have power objects to support them in that. And we're going to talk about everyone from the Caesars to Napoleon and Hitler and on down the line. So why is it that you all of a sudden got the spark to go back into this research that we had done earlier, following the provenance of the Spear of Antioch?
Well, I wondered that myself. And then as I really began, I was really kind of chasing intuition here. And then at some point during the study of Klaus Schwab's history in southern Germany, Bavaria, and in Switzerland and in Austria, and Liechtenstein, some things started to come in focus. And some of it deals with the research you had done years ago on the Holy Grail, and I think you still write on. And I began to realize that we're the area of the world that Klaus Schwab was born into and has been raised up in is that very region where the Holy Lance of Antioch very likely passed through his hometown at least three times. In our research, we believe three times. And it was passing back and forth between the estate of its discovery in Antioch during the First Crusade, and then the stewardship of it by Raymond of Toulouse and his family over hundreds of years. And as we began looking at the historical records of the various crusades, I think there were eight, we see this passage back and forth from southern France, northern Spain, to the Holy Land. One of the routes was the north of the Alps, and that would have gone right through the area that Klaus Schwab was born into. And so, and then when we found the very deep relationship between Klaus Schwab's family and Adolf Hitler, it sparked the notion that, wow, there's some connection here with the Holy Lance. And then what we now know from reading the volumes of speculation about what they call the Holy Lance, or the, what's the other term? The Spear of Destiny. There have been many books written on the Spear of Destiny, and we learned that Adolf Hitler had an occult fascination with finding and holding the lance that pierced Christ's side. And he believed that if he held that, he would have power over the whole world, and that if he didn't hold it, that he would be defeated. And so when he seized Austria, I can't remember the name of the German name of that movement into Austria, but it,
Anschluss,
yes. No shots were fired. His first act was to go to the Habsburg treasury and seize control of the lance that was there with the other Habsburg regalia as his first act of power. And he believed he seized the actual spear that pierced Christ's side. We don't believe that now. We believe he, at best, obtained a second-class relic that probably had been in contact with the Holy Lance, but was not the Holy Lance. So Klaus Schwab and his family carried on this tradition of seeking power over the whole world, consistent with this occult fascination of Hitler with finding the Holy Lance. And the fact that it passed through Klaus's hometown, there's something there. The demons there don't like this.
Megalomaniacs love the Spear of Destiny. And the story, now I can get into great detail with the story, as you full well know, because when we were given the opportunity to study the provenance of the Spear of Antioch, we came up with just so much amazing research that it led me to write a book called Hidden History of the Grail Queens. And in that, we put a provenance of the Grail, of many Grails, but, you know, the Holy Lance is also considered part of the Grail. Matter of fact, the lance is usually coupled with a chalice or some kind of cup or something. Even in the Habsburg reliquary, where you'll find the what we now call the Spear of Maurice, supposedly the oldest of the assumed to be, and as you say, second-class relics that are the Spear of Destiny. The real Spear of Destiny, or at least something more ancient than that, because when that Spear of Maurice was tested, it was tested either 7th or 8th century, I can't remember. But basically, it was made by the Pope to give to Charlemagne and to the Frankish rulers. And then remember, Charlemagne was made the first Holy Roman Emperor. Well, that spear head, it's not the whole spear, the spear head was held sacred by the Franks and the Germans, and then the Hohenstaufens and the Hohenzollerns and then the Habsburgs for 800 years. For 800 years, they believed that that was the spear that stabbed the side of Christ. Now, we need to get a little bit esoteric here. What would it matter that, or where does the power come from for this spear? And what? Why does it have something to do with blood? Well, that's where it gets absolutely amazing and can go many different directions. But Longinus had a hosta nova.
Longinus.
Pardon me?
He's Saint Longinus.
Saint Longinus, who was a centurion. He had a spearhead, which was traditional, given to him by his father. He was in Israel, and his father had been stationed in Israel. And that's the only place you're going to come across a hosta nova magus that has meteorite in it. And the spear that we examined is consistent with having meteorite in it and has absolutely been confirmed by experts to be a first century hosta of that only a centurion carried. It was a shorter spear. So the spear that stabs the side of Christ, what's the significance? Well, the blood of Christ needed to reach the earth so that it could renew the earth. Let's put it that way. It was like etheric spiritual seeds for the earth. And so stabbing the side of Christ also saved his bones from being broken. And because they say St. Longinus was blind, some of the blood came in his eye and healed him, so he was no longer blind. That basically means he was a sinner and he turned into a follower of the way of Christ, you know, the way, the truth, the life, the way of Christ, which is really very much for those who are out there doing war and, like Longinus, just following orders, but all of a sudden you decide you want to be a Christian and turn the other cheek. You want to take your sword and give it back, and you want to give up your commission. You don't want to be a centurion and in charge of 100 men.
The term Christian was not used yet at that time. It only occurred later in Antioch, where he was martyred later.
Would you tell us the story of Peter of Antioch? Because that's where we have to go next.
Well, another reason this is very meaningful to me is that in my Christian journey, my parents were Southern Baptist. I went to Methodist Church in high school. I went on the road with an interdenominational gospel singing group, playing trombone, traveling all over the world. And in the process of turning over practically every stone in Christendom, I really began to see the theological base of Christianity, and found a home in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And specifically, I was chrismated by the Metropolitan of the Antiochian Orthodox Church in America. So the Church of Antioch has a special place in me and my family. And we know the history well, that after the Christians, the apostles, were basically forced to leave Jerusalem, the main contingent of that community went to Antioch, which is in southern Turkey, next to Lebanon, Syria. And that is the place, according to the book of Acts, where believers in Christ were first called Christians. And specifically, St. Peter went there, and he was the first bishop of the church in Antioch. Now, this was before he went to Rome. So, you know, they call the Pope, has the keys of St. Peter. Well, there's a nuance to that story in that St. Peter was first the bishop of Antioch. And at he's founded a church, St. Peter's, of the Church of St. Peter in Antioch. And this is the site of the place where, in a vision, one of the soldiers of Raymond of St. Giles, or Raymond of Toulouse, had a vision that they would find the spear buried under the altar in the Church of St. Peter in 1198, I believe it was, or 1098, at the beginning of the First Crusade. And in fact, they found what we believe the current Holy Lance of Antioch is. It's that particular spear that they found during the First Crusade. So Antioch holds a very special place in Christendom, has from the beginning. And in fact, the church in Jerusalem was initially sending essentially care and prayers to the Church of Antioch, which was one of the first churches established by the apostles after the resurrection.
And then Raymond, being the leader of the Crusaders, used it to go and defeat three cities in a row and then take Jerusalem.
Correct.
And then went for a little battle.
I need to add here. We skip over they had three battles and he got to Jerusalem. No, the first, the battle in Antioch, the spear was found after they had seized the city, and then they became surrounded by a 5-to-1 odds against them by the Seljuk Turks, who were Muslims trying to take back the city. And it was then that they discovered the Holy Lance. And in the visions, Peter Bartholomew, one of his soldiers, was told to put this out in front of the army and that they would defeat the larger enemy that, in fact, had sieged them, and that they had resorted to eating leather because they had run out of food, and the siege by the Seljuk Turks was pretty successful. So the idea that they could even win was probably out of their minds by then. So when they put the lance in front of the army and they were able to defeat their 5-to-1 odds, it was a miracle, and Raymond of Toulouse believed it was a miracle, as did most of their soldiers.
And these were very serious people. I mean, I think it was, if not this battle, another one where they were told they had to go barefoot, or in between walking from one city to the next, they had to go barefoot.
That was Ascalon, the Battle of Ascalon after that.
Okay, so then from Antioch, there was a miracle. They used this spear as the banner of victory to rally around, and because they believe that it's real. And then they defeat a few other cities. They take Jerusalem. And then after they take Jerusalem, you know, Raymond could have been the king of Jerusalem.
Correct. He turned it down.
But in fact, he allowed it to go to someone else. And then later, strangely enough, in our story, I'll come back to this, there were queens of Jerusalem, two of them in a row. And they are actually part of the whole story, because when these females, if they're an infantata or infantado, if they're married or not married, the relics of the church can be held by them for the sake of the Pope in their own fortress, because the Pope can't defend all these relics. But we'll get to that in just a second. So anyway, you have this most holy relic being buried in St. Peter's Church in Antioch. They dig it up. It's used as the banner. It wins the day, wins Jerusalem. And then in a battle outside, wasn't that called Andalusia or something? Anyway, the last battle of Raymond IV there outside of Jerusalem, the spear just disappears.
Right. After he had it with him to baptize his young son, Alfonso Jordan.
In a big deal.
Jordan being, that was a part of the vision, actually, of Peter Bartholomew to baptize Alfonso in the River Jordan, which they did with the spear there and some other relics that they had found. And so it was after that Raymond died.
So, you can ask yourself the question, really, the victory banner, the spear that stabbed the side of Christ was just glossed by Raymond? It fell off the cart? It doesn't make any sense. Of course not. What happened was his son and his wife went back to Europe.
Right.
It was sent back with her and under her protection as a married, I don't remember whether infantata. Anyway, one of them is a married woman who is holding the fort for her husband who's gone off for the Pope to win Jerusalem for the Pope.
Right.
Well, it's a good deal. So she was very Spanish influenced. What was her name? Elvira of...
of Castilla.
Castile.
And by the way, that trip back from the First Crusade would have gone through Ravensburg.
You see that Ravensburg is a central place. And what we see here is that she got back there. All kinds of strange things happened. Finally, Raymond came back there, and then he started to lead some more battles, which again, he was undefeated in. So we wonder if he wasn't using the spear at that time. And then he goes into obscurity for a minute, and then he comes back to do another crusade, and he doesn't make it, and he actually gets killed. Well, I believe...
You're referring to Alfonso, his son.
Oh, right. Alfonso, yes.
Right.
And so what happens is the spear goes back to the feminine line, the female line, the line that's protected by the Pope, by the infantata rule or the infantado, and that these females, especially the northern Spain, southern French kings and queens, were obsessed with the blood lineage of Christ, anything to do with sacred relics, anything to do with relics. The pilgrimage to Saint Compostelo starts on one side of France and goes to the other side. People literally dedicated their lives to go on pilgrimages to see these relics. These relics were so holy to them that they meant more than anything in the world. Their whole faith was determined by just seeing the bones of St. James and St. James of Compostelo, just seeing his bones, being told those are his bones, somehow that gave them faith. Well, what I noticed, and I had noticed that, strangely enough, I don't know, there might be other researchers of the Holy Grail, but the blood relic started with, of course, Jesus. So the spear that stabbed his side, blood relic. The chalice that caught it, blood relic.
Crucifixion garment.
I was thinking of the name for that. The garment that he wore that got bloody and was ripped up and sold. The thorns on his head. The cross that touched his shoulder and made him bleed. Everything that had to do with blood, including, strangely enough, even the foreskin of his circumcision. Anything to do with the blood of Christ, they were obsessed with. So ask yourself the question, if they were so obsessed with it, what would they have done with it? There's only one answer. They would have given it to his mother.
Can I interject? When you say the word obsessed, I would have used the word revered.
Yes, much better.
I don't think that they were enamored by it as such, but they truly believed that Christ was the Son of God and therefore is the Son of God, and therefore any item of matter in this world that had anything to do with him carried the stamp of divinity on it. And that is basically why the church venerates relics, because those relics have the stamp of divinity on them in their current condition. Whether the person's alive or not is irrelevant. That they Absolutely. Can still carry blessing.
Absolutely. So then they were told by Christ to do the Last Supper, you know, do this in remembrance of me. And what's at the Last Supper? Well, there is a chalice along the lines of the Jewish chalices that were used at the Passover. But in this case, it's like the chalice of mercy and compassion all rolled into one. So whether you could believe in the Holy Grail or not, that Joseph of Arimathea used this special grail that fell from the sky, which is a green emerald, on and on and on and on and on. You can get into all their traditions, but they all essentially come down to, on the table is a goblet so people can share the blood of Christ, or the wine that turns into the blood of Christ, and the bread. And the bread has to either be broken, or in the Eastern Church, they cut it. And what do they cut it with? A little symbolic spear of Longinus.
Correct.
And so I say, this is completely my own conjecture, and you can throw it out the window if you want, but I think it's only logical, and that when you hear this, you'll go, well, of course that happened. Longinus became Saint Longinus because he became the first true believer who even, you know, who believed because of the miracle of his sight coming back, but because he had spent 2 years following Christ and watching him. And when he saw him die, he had mercy on him, didn't want his legs broken, so he stabbed his side so that Joseph of Arimathea could catch the blood and complete the blood mysteries and the Holy Grail mysteries. Well, what happened to Longinus's spear? In my version, the spear broke in half and the spearhead fell off. And the spearhead was given to Mary. And Mary and the apostles, Peter, who conducted oftentimes the Last Supper ritual, or the Holy Meal, the Communion, the Holy Eucharist, whatever you want to call it, he would have been the one who would cut the bread with the spear. Because why? The spear pierced the side of Christ, the body of Christ. The bread represents the body of Christ. The grail represents our own ego that can catch what it is that Christ has to give to us. So it doesn't really matter whether there's a real grail. It matters whether you are a vessel to catch that in yourself. And it matters whether or not you are going to have the compassion of Longinus to go from being a soldier to a defender of the grail, a guardian of the grail, someone who's on the way towards truth and life, the way, the truth, and life. So I found it completely obvious that the real blood mysteries of the Holy Grail, which are oftentimes literally linked together as Holy Blood, Holy Grail, in some of the many of the representations, because they also believed that the Holy Blood could be Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a child.
Well, didn't you conduct a pretty thorough study of this in travels to Europe?
Oh, yes. I studied a lot of this when I was there, went firsthand to the places. And so, and at the time I was very psychic, as you'd call it. So I was able to, you know, find things that, you know, were very interesting. So when we put together this...
What does that mean? Interesting. I don't know what that means.
Interesting means another whole show on just what it is that I'd find in these places. For instance, held sacred is the throne of Charlemagne, right? Mm-hmm. Because I forget how many, but many, 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 many German leaders, all the Habsburgs and everybody, take their are coronated on the throne of Charlemagne. Well, when I get to Aachen, I decide, you know, to jump over the gate and go sit on the throne and see how it feels. Those kind of things. So there are many things with the Grail mysteries that if you go and you check them out, you'll find that they're very, very real. Because if you sit on that throne and you make a sound, because of the way that the octagonal, beautiful Gothic church is arranged, your voice, it sounds like the voice of God. It's just amazing. No wonder they revered it and revered that particular spot. So, you know, you see that there's some of it is animistic, some of it is very simplistic, and, you know, we'd call it unscientific, but it doesn't really matter. Just like the secondhand relics, just because it touched.
So are you saying what you were trying to do is sort out all of these different interpretations of what you had read before, and we're trying to get to the facts of the matter? And I understand you studied the legends of the Holy Grail quite a bit. And that's the reason I want to mention that now is because, you know me, I start putting a timeline to things because I wanted to see if there were any facts to either corroborate or contradict some of these things you were describing, mostly in legend. And I got to tell you, it's quite amazing how the facts line up time-wise with the things you are finding.
You are so right. The thin line between history and legend in this book that I've written, Hidden History of the Grail Queens, is very thin. But the circumstantial evidence, as you know, you and I couldn't go on with the provenance for our project to demonstrate that the spear that we were examining was indeed the spear of Antioch. Matter of fact, I think we left it with the fact that the people who had examined this spear that we had looked at said that it had been kept for a long, long time, indicating hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years in a vacuum sealed area because it was so well preserved. And so we had traced it back to Sancha, Queen of Castile and Leon, and her sepulcher, and the fact that it was wax sealed. And we believe that it was in there with her body as a protection by the Grail Queens.
And it had a carving, and it had a carving relief of a soldier on a horse carrying a lance of similar shape to what we see now.
It looks as if it tells the story of Longinus.
Right.
And kind of the history of what you go through from being a soldier to a guardian of the Grail. And so Sanchez was a very occult Spanish queen who had just tremendous power. Her daughter, Urraca, I think is the basis of Grail stories from a Spanish point of view, because they'd been fighting the Muslims long beforehand. And so the whole idea that they were fighting for Christianity, and it's really Christianity that's behind the Grail. So if you look at Christianity as it came and spread across Europe, especially the Occident, southern France, northern Spain, it became directly connected with all the blood relics of Jesus of Nazareth. So connected that you can hardly separate them. Matter of fact, the original stories of the Holy Grail were all about literally the blood, the very things I'm talking about, the Christian elements of it. It was Joseph of Arimathea who had the Grail and who had the magic table. And when you look at all of these things, you can see that there's a, you could call it a mishmash, but really it's a condensing of the great wisdom of the past, both with Celtic mythology, Irish mythology, Norse mythology, all of the latest to come to earth mythologies. For instance, Odin and his spear. The spear of Longinus has always been considered to be so powerful. Well, the spear of Odin never misses. Gungnir, I think, is its name. And it never misses and always returns to his hand. It began the Ragnarok, the war at the end of times. This spear is incredibly powerful, and he hung himself on the world tree with that spear and stabbed himself in his own side with that spear. And that was before the time of Christ. People were worshiping these things.
When you talk about all these legends, I've always found them interesting, and certainly they can be instructive in the lessons that they try to teach. What I tried to do was with the legends of the Holy Grail was to pay attention to them, kind of determine when they emerged, and at the same time, look at the timeline as best we could find facts. There are a lot more facts than I ever thought you could find. Some of these medievalists were extremely meticulous with their descriptions. And their one of the things about the Crusades, which was really helpful, is that usually two or three priests would accompany each of the Crusades and would document on a daily basis what they were doing. And so we have a lot of detail about the events that occurred. But as you said, one of the ones that was striking was how after Raymond died, the documentation of the Holy Lance from all of these Crusades just went away.
Yes.
And I think we figured out why. And we've traced back and forth the stories, when it's appeared and when it hasn't appeared, with what was happening in the world. And one thing I can say is it looks to me like the legends of the Grail Queens were not legends. But in fact, as the Holy Lance was in the stewardship of the Countesses of Toulouse, there were probably rumors that these were around. But some of these legends probably developed to divert people from too much attention to the actual spear. And then, and or it was a way to, those rumors became legends. They were the legends out of the facts that occurred. And that's what we're seeing now, is that this stewardship of these holy women over the centuries has kept that holy relic in the amazing state that it is today. And as that scientist you're referring to said, he's never seen a first century centurion spearhead in such good condition. He said normally they're iron or steel, and they rust. And this one, because of, I think, things like the sealed sarcophagus and other things like that, is how it was kept in such good shape.
Now, you had mentioned that the Christians moved to Ephesus or to that area, and Antioch, and then with Mary they went on and a little further to Ephesus. And so you get to see that the Christians really had their headquarters over there. So you can follow the Grail, the blood legends. You can follow the Veil of Veronica. You can follow the Shroud of Turin. You know, these things. You can look at these, and then you can see that outside of Mary's house in Ephesus, she created the rosary, and she had stations for the rosary, and that's the reason they believe that it had to have been her house and the house that she lived in for some time, and then later laid down for 3 days, and then after that she rose up into heaven in front of all of her followers. But she every day would go out, and she would.
That today, to this day, is a feast in the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church. It's called
August 15th.
Feast of the Dormition.
Yes. Oh, yes. And then the Ascension on the 15th. Yes. And so every day she'd go out into this little area, and you can see the remnants of it. And she created the Way of the Cross. And the Way of the Cross is really a way to reverence the bloodletting of Jesus. Every time that he let blood for us, there is a holy reverence in the Way of the Cross stations. And I believe that that was created by Mary there at Ephesus, and we have literally the physical garden that she did this in. So that became what was called the Way. And the Way has continued to this day. It's Christianity when it's really being Christianity. And where do you find the Holy Grail? Well, that's in the Eucharist in Christianity. So you still find the blood and the body being turned into, I mean, wine or grape juice and bread being turned into the blood and body of Jesus, which again is, you know, this miraculous transformation, transubstantiation. And what they're saying here is that's what you need to do.
Right.
That's your job. And so the search for the Holy Grail is the search to turn your heart into the Grail to receive the blood of Christ, or other, in other words, your higher self, And the spear is to take the spear off the lance and to not use it to harm, but use it to cut your bread.
Yep.
And then you're peaceful. And then you started the way. Well, that they went there, and then you could follow easily that the spear was then in Constantinople, and it was always reverenced by the queens of the kings of Constantinople, you know, like Justinian and Theodora. And I believe that it was Theodora who took the spear from Constantinople back to Antioch and buried it there, because for a variety of reasons I'm not going to go into. And then that's how it lay in the ground for a while, and again was preserved because it was in the ground. And then when it was dug up again later in 1098 by the First Crusade, then we can trace it to Toulouse. I mean, we could trace it to Elvira coming back to Toulouse and throughout France there. And then we believe that it went into the Spanish queen's hands, and it was passed along with great reverence. And then it was found again later by the Hohenstaufen lineage through marriage, Spanish and Habsburg, what later was Habsburg, you know, Austrian-German marriage. It ended up in the imperial regalia, but they didn't know what it was. They didn't understand that that thing that they thought was just an old spear was in fact the holy spear. And then when the Pope made a fake version of it called the Spear of Maurice, there were multiple copies made of that fake copy.
Which often happens, by the way, mm-hmm. with relics. So when somebody has a real relic, then they make these second-class relics. That doesn't mean it's not a pejorative. It just means it's not the real thing, but it has blessing. And so it's very common that they would have probably taken multiple spears, blessed them with the actual lance, and then distributed them. That's what
that's why there's the so many nails. That's why there's so many pieces to the cross. Yeah.
Well, that's often a criticism leveled against people who say, oh, there's all these relics all over the place, and if you put them all together, it'd be five times what the original was. Well, think about this. Let's say all of those relics that everybody's criticizing were, in fact, in contact with the real relic and passed around for the blessing of people all around the world. That makes sense. So all of a sudden, this criticism is turned on its head, and in fact, all the cynicism that occurs around relics should pass away, because the real point is the blessing that we receive from the Holy Eucharist and its ability to save us and those around us and our world.
Yes, and then we find that the female line that protected the Grail and the male line that held the Grail, oftentimes using it as a power source for winning victories in battles, they kind of came together, and somehow the Grail, the spear, was mixed in with everything else in the imperial regalia of the Hohenstaufens, which later became the regalia, imperial regalia of the Habsburgs. And then we know that it moved around a bit, but we can see here that from the time of the Romans, and I didn't mention this, but they revered the spear also, but then they had already revered spears before that. But when this spear came along, they revered it tremendously. So that's the reason Maurice was a Roman soldier. And so when you gave a spear, it was giving a sign of tremendous victory and power. So we can follow it with some, basically, you have to surmise some of the providence of this spear, whether it goes through the female or the male line. But one thing's for sure. Once it was in the imperial regalia, we know that it was coveted by everyone of that time. It was held by the Habsburgs, the ruling power for 800 years. Holy Roman Emperors. And when Napoleon wanted to come to power, he was storming Nuremberg. The closer he got to Nuremberg, they packed up the imperial regalia and they moved it to three different cities to hide it. Later, Hitler, same thing. It was they were hiding it there, I believe, in Nuremberg, and Hitler was getting...
Well, it was in Vienna, and he moved it to Nuremberg.
I'm sorry. It was reversed. And then the stories in Spear of Destiny tell the way that he was an art studio student, and he went to the treasury of the Habsburgs, and he would draw pictures of the spear, and he was obsessed with the spear. I don't doubt that he was obsessed with the spear, but Trevor Ravenscroft's book, Spear of Destiny, Cannot Be Trusted, I know this because he was one of three students of Walter Johannes Stein, and his three students were Werner Glas, René Garrido, who were both teachers of mine, and Trevor Ravenscroft. Well, Trevor Ravenscroft wrote two books, and they're sensationalistic, but they're really cool, and they got a lot of people interested in the topic, so we applaud him. But the point is you can't trust everything in it, so you got to do your own homework, and you got to do your own research, and that's what we did. That's what we put into this book, so you can find the provenance as far as we can tell you, right down to the time when Baron von Hugel was asked by the city of Nuremberg to take the imperial regalia from Nuremberg back to Vienna. And he says, sure, I'll do that. But first he took it to his town of Regensburg, not Ravensburg.
Which is not too far away from Ravensburg.
144 miles. So again, it passes through this corridor that it keeps passing through. And when he gets to Vienna, well, good old Baron von Hugel decides, I'm not going to give the Habsburg imperial regalia to the Habsburgs. I'm going to keep it for myself. And so then later he sells it to them, and they literally are stupid enough. They literally buy it from him. And that included, of course, the Spear of Maurice and the holy chalice that they say is the Holy Grail. It did not include the Spear of Antioch, because we know that it didn't. And the Spear of Antioch, at some point in Vienna, we believe that it was turned over somehow to the Templars, and that the Templars were holding it. And then somehow, I'm not going to get into the details of that, someone came into possession of it who said that they wanted, it had healing power, and they sent it to us to check it out. So we checked it out. And what we can say is that it's the most authentic first century Roman centurion Hosta Novia Magus anywhere in any museum in the world. So that's if right. It is not the authentic thing, it is as close as it gets. Now, why would Klaus Schwab want it? Because he's just like Napoleon. He's just like the Caesars. He's just like Hitler. He wants control of the world. Just, if you listen to what he's saying, he's basically saying everything must go this way. It must be divided this way because this is the way my company is divided. And these are the services that my company can provide.
Well, let me throw in a factoid there. When he started the World Economic Forum in 71, I don't think he did. I think it was Henry Kissinger and the Pilgrims. But anyway, he's the guy on the label. His first speaker, his keynote speaker, was Otto von Habsburg, the Black Monarch who would be the king of the Fourth Reich. So what he was doing, I think, was telling the whole of Europe and the rest of the world that what we're going to do here is going to create the Fourth Reich. And here, look, we've got Otto von Habsburg giving blessing to what we're doing here, folks. That's how significant what you're saying is, Douglas.
Oh, yes. And these people believe that they're the blood lineage of Jesus. The Windsors believe they're the blood lineage. Present king of Spain, Juan Carlos's son, Philippe, well, they believe he's the blood lineage of Christ, and they also believe the Habsburgs are. So literally, you have so many levels of stories going on in this that to believe that these people would really covet something like the Spear of Maurice, even knowing that scientific testing proved that it was created after the seventh, after the eighth century. Well, then why would you want that as a power object? Because it has been held by the great rulers of Europe as a power object, and that's a fact. Mm-hmm. So we know that the Spear of Maurice has all the juju in it. It's got all the good energy. It's got all this faith and belief. And we also know that the Spear of Antioch led the Crusaders into their first victory in Jerusalem. Right. So we know that these things are empowered by people's prayer, by their beliefs. And so you cannot diminish the significance of what these things mean to the people who covet them. And I must admit, okay, I read The Spear of Destiny when I was young, okay? And I went to Europe, and the first time I went there, I stood in front of that Spear of Maurice over and over and over again to see if it was real. Just like Hitler, just like Napoleon, just like Klaus Schwab. And, you know, but Klaus, here's the deal. Hitler made a copy of it, and he sent it to the Antarctic. This is what people believe. Klaus Schwab would not be looking to get the one from Vienna because he knows that's a fake. He's going to go after the real one, which, of course, is not real. But he would go after the trail of the Nazis, and that would probably lead to South America. So is there one, the real Spear of Maurice floating around someplace? Yes, it is. Is the one in Vienna real? It's a copy of the copy. And then there's a copy in Prague, in Poland. Not a very good copy, but there's a copy there. And there's one other copy.
Somewhere in Czechoslovakia or Slovakia?
I'm not sure.
In a castle?
Oh.
There's another one.
Yeah, there is. I can't think of this the country that it's in. But, you know, they got a little bit obsessed with saying, well, look, you know, I'll just make a look-alike and I'll touch it to the one that was touched to. And even if it's a third-class relic, I'm pleased with that. That's fine. It can still represent for me what it means to go from the soldier to the guardian of the grail.
Right. So what we see is power mongers, people who desire to control humanity, to control the world, just the opposite of the message of Christ, attempting to gain possession of something that at best they should seek in order to find their own salvation. But in fact, they're trying to use it as a sword of power over the world. And what I find so fascinating of the current location of the Holy Lance of Antioch, which I believe at this stage, with all of the research we've done, is authentic. I think it really was. It is the, and we've seen some miraculous things happen with it since it's been in the possession of the current stewardess. That it's come into the possession of people who are promoting the idea that you can't have this power over the world and that we need to call all of humanity to another level where we get back to the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The guide for the future is very simple, and it's that power that's actually stronger than all the power currently being wielded against us by the Pilgrim Society. And also, you haven't brought this up, and maybe you're going to, is the issue of where is the battle now? The battle is in our bloodstreams. And isn't it curious that the Holy Lance spilt Christ's blood to save the whole world? And so now we're bound to, we're at a battle of blood. I find that fascinating.
Well, every TV show starts off with some bloodletting. There has to be lots of blood, but it's the grotesque, it's the vile, it's the it's disgusting. So you got to ask yourself the question: are you going to shed the blood of others, or are you going to shed your blood for others? So in the Rosicrucian system, there's a symbol of the pelican. And the pelican has ran out of food, but it has babies. So it literally takes its beak and opens up its heart and starts feeding its heart to its babies. So when you have the spear of Longinus, it isn't powerful because it stabbed the side of the most powerful being whoever was on the face of the earth, who was incarnating the spirit of Christ for the last three years of his life. And so therefore you think it might be charged up with that energy and you might get that energy. Well, that's just selfish pigheadedness. And you know, all you're going to get from that is probably some demon coming around asking if they can jump in you because you're so stupid. So no, really, that's what would happen. If you had the spear, you know, one of these spears, and you didn't know what you're doing with it, the demons will come around.
You're not talking metaphorically, are you?
No,
you
I'm
know,
not.
You know this from experience.
Yes, I do. So what you have here is you need to be the pelican. You need to realize that love is the outflowing of your blood. It's the outflowing of your warmth. It's the outflowing of your grace and your mercy. All the things of the divine that you can manifest through yourself, well, that is what the Holy Grail is supposed to do. When you get near the Grail, what happens? All of your needs are met. If you're thirsty, then the Grail provides to drink. If you're hungry, it provides food. If no matter what it is, whatever your lack is, the Grail will provide it. Now, I'm not going to go into the history of the Maidens of the Grail. You'll have to get the book if you want to really read the true history and why it really came about, because this is also happening quite literally in the worlds, the unseen worlds around us. And so the Grail mystery, there is no end to it. You can study it for all the rest of your life and you'll still only scratch the surface. Next to Christology, I would have to say that Grail is right up there in the top 10 things that people have written about over the years. Why? Because it is an archetype that can go into the future. The Grail, you could say, is your heart, but you can't say the Grail is any one thing. So when it comes down to it, the Grail is a chalice that is catching the blood dripping from the tip of a spear, but the spear is moving through the air by itself and it's filled with light. And the blood that is dripping into the chalice later feeds everybody whatever they need. And what is often forgot is that Réponse de Soi is the female guardian of the Grail. She carries the Grail. Well, the Grail maidens, they've already gone through the process of purification. But when you are going to be Parsifal or Feraphis, or you're going to be Gawain or any Percival, anybody trying to attain the Grail, well, if you're attaining it through the sword, then you have a lot to learn. And we can see that the wounded king of the Grail, you know, something wounded the king. What wounded the king? Well, again, it's the spear had wounded him. And it had wounded him in a way that he couldn't really do his duties, and then the land starts to falter. Well, that's you. You are the king of the Grail. You are the bearer of the Grail. You are Parsifal coming to the Grail. That's you. That's your story. And you can tell it through the Christian version. We can call it the Way, and you can use Longinus and other saints as examples. You can do it through sheer consciousness by talking about it physically. Literally, there are physical things that happen when this transformation happens in you, when you actually understand the Holy Grail. You can go to the history. But let me tell you, the history is little known. And the history is often so obscured that in all the books I've read in the Grail, which are many, 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 I can't say any of them ever really had a true handle on it except what Rudolf Steiner tells us. And even then, you're going to have to read 30 different versions of what Steiner tells you the Grail is.
Yeah, can I interrupt you there? That was one of the things that we noticed, and we probably, I don't know, studied 300 or 400 source texts. And one of the things that we discovered in all these historical writings about the Grail is that historians are not immune from propaganda. And what we saw is that whenever the narrative that they were writing about the Grail didn't fit with their politics, it was interesting how they would start leaving things out. And so what it reinforced again, what we're seeing today is that this history of the last 120 years since the beginning of modern propaganda, has written out of history anything that was inconvenient for this evil narrative. And we saw that in these historical documents going back a couple thousand years. So these chroniclers sometimes were cynical, and they would skew their feedback a certain way. And you really had to read a lot of different narratives to try to figure out how this story actually occurred. And facts were usually missing from the ones that were pushing politics, no matter what century they were in.
Well, your research, when you came up with adding the Spear of Antioch or the Spear of Destiny to Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum, I was shocked at first, but there's no doubt that his new fourth industrial revolution is nothing more than the Fourth Reich. And there is no doubt that, like Hitler, he will desire the power objects that can turn the world into his own. He wants to be the ruler of the world. And if not him, there's others. And so this gives a beautiful example of the fact that materialism can lead to the point that you can then covet something that is literally, you know, it's not real, but even the fake will do, because you need everything you can to support your materialistic views. So I thought it was fascinating that you could bring something so spiritual into what was some of the most grotesque views of where the globalists want to take us with their World Economic Forum agenda. And but I'm glad you did, because it gave us a chance to talk about some spiritual things, which everybody really needs to hear at this time of darkness. So thank you so much for bringing this to light for us. You got any closing words for us?
No, I think that this continuing revelation that we're having is helping us to get to the root of this problem that we're dealing with today, and that what we're sorting through is these layers of centuries of propaganda from people who want that power, that evil power that they think this these fake lances can give them. But in fact, I find it just amazing how what I believe is the true Holy Lance of Antioch is in the hands of a godly stewardess right now. And the call to higher values, i.e. love, is at the center of this new possession of the Holy Lance.